Colossians chapter 1 says something that I think introduces for us what we've been talking about all year. At the beginning of each month, we've been doing a sermon that is part of a larger theme about putting on the image of Christ. I want to keep in mind as we go through this all year that even though I'm calling it something like being renewed or putting on the image of Christ, that it's actually God's work. It's actually God's work. As much as I try to encourage each of us to get serious about disciplining ourselves and doing what we need to do to make this happen, really what it is overall is a submission to God's work. God's the one who renews the spirit of Christ in me. God's the one who makes me different. God's the one who changes me fundamentally. I'm the one who submits to it. Look at Colossians chapter 1. Notice what I think to be kind of the theme of the book. Notice verse 27. And this is talking about us saints, us Christians, and it says, "To whom God willed to make known what is the riches of the glory of the mystery among the Gentiles, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory." If there's one phrase that I think describes the book of Colossians, it's that phrase, Christ in you. Now, this verse says that that was kind of the mystery that through time God was wanting to reveal, that what he was eventually going to do was he was going to take people who were broken and he was going to put Christ in them. He was going to remake them. And Christ in me is, look at the verse again, the hope of glory. I don't know what you hope for someday. I don't know what you look forward to about your future, your eternity. But there's no greater hope than this idea of glory. That you and I will be glorified. That we'll be exactly what God meant for us to be. And the process by which he brings us to glory happens now. In this renewal that Colossians chapter 3 talks about, where we are renewed to the image of the Creator who made us. Now, what we've been doing all year is we've been looking at different words from Colossians chapter 3, verses 5 through 17. There are at least 12 different descriptions, 12 different characteristics, that as we implement those and understand what they mean and begin to live them, they are the characteristics of Jesus Christ. We're halfway through. Isn't that crazy? It's already halfway through 2009. We've talked about a lot of important things. Today we're going to talk about forgiveness. I want you, just for a moment, to look at this list and imagine that Christ lacked one of these. That Christ, in his nature and in his character, something was missing from this list in him. Which thing would you choose? And I guess we could say that about Christ, we could say that about ourselves. But what if Christ wasn't any of these? Everything, I think, would fall apart on some level because in some way they're all interrelated. In some way they all become God himself. But what about this word this month? Forgiveness. How important is forgiveness to you? Think about your own life and the things you've done, the things you've done wrong, the times you failed, the times you haven't lived up to what you knew you should have. And if it wasn't for this characteristic of forgiveness, where would you be? And as God begins to tell us in this text that we are to become people who forgive, we're not really going to make any headway at all in this lesson if we can't first connect with how important it is that God's like this with us. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Let's go ahead and look at Colossians chapter 3, verse 13. The verse says, "Bearing with one another and forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you." There's a few things to say about this verse. And we'll talk about it. But let's start with just the word forgiveness for a minute. I'm not going to take too much time to define it. In the Greek, the word forgiveness is something like cherizomai. It comes from the word cheris or cheris. Does anybody happen to know what word that is? The Greek word cheris is grace. The word forgiveness is the same word or comes from the same word as grace. And that's quite important, especially as regards our forgiveness of others. Because almost every time we talk about forgiving somebody, it is always going to seem like they don't deserve it. But that's right. It is grace. Look again at that verse, and let me just point out a couple of other things to you in that verse. It says there, whoever has a complaint against anyone. Now, let's go ahead and apply that. Are you in that verse somewhere? You've got words like whoever, and you've got words like anyone. And there's two parts to this. There might be people sitting here that think they've been hurt too much. The pain is too deep. The wrong was too long. Whatever the reason is that you believe that you don't need to forgive or don't, it's not enjoined upon you to forgive. I want you to look again at the word whoever. You're there. Now, for those of you that might think, well, there are certain people that I understand I should forgive, but there's some people that don't deserve my forgiveness, again, because of how they've hurt me. And then I'd have you look at the word anyone. And there in that verse, too. I have to tell you, forgiveness is one of those things that's very, very hard for me. For a lot of reasons, and I don't need to tell you all my stories. I don't need to tell you all the times that I've been hurt. The other reason it's hard for me is not just because I've been hurt. It's because I know I've hurt some people so badly and so deeply that it scares me whether or not they'll ever forgive me or whether or not God will ever forgive me. So there's some things about forgiveness that I think are very difficult. Not just to understand what it really is and what it means and what it looks like, but then maybe the greater challenge, finding the strength to forgive. Some of you sit here this morning, perhaps having grown up with parents who never one time, in your estimation, made you feel important. It seemed like every time they spoke, you weren't good enough. Every time they spoke, you'd done something wrong. Everything they said was negative. And you've not ever figured out how to let go of that hurt or that bitterness about that upbringing. Some of you may sit here this morning having been sexually abused by somebody. And the pain of that is not something that I can understand. But perhaps you're thinking in your heart, you don't understand how deep that pain is. I can't fathom forgiveness. Perhaps you're a parent whose child has spit in your face after you've loved them and said, I don't care about your love. I don't care about your example. I don't care about your anything. You leave me alone. Those are things that, to be fair, are very real and very hard. But again, in that verse, it says, whoever has a complaint against anyone. I don't know that it matters what the complaint is. We've got to figure out what this verse is teaching. So let's start with this. What is forgiveness? Look again at the verse and let's see if we can find the answer here. Bearing with one another and forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. Now, we'll make a couple of points from this, but I want you to notice that the standard of forgiveness enjoined upon us is nothing less than the way God forgave us. As the Lord forgave, so we should forgive. In that we have a model, and we also have a definition, and we have some motivation. But what's the definition? How did the Lord forgive us? Point number one is, He didn't just ignore our sin. You know, sometimes I've been tempted in my forgiveness of others to just sort of think of forgiveness as, well, I'm just going to ignore that it happened. You know, the problem, and maybe you're not like this, but the problem with me is that's sort of self-deception because I never really ignore it. I say that I'm ignoring it, but it's just one more time that they do it, or one more look at their face, or one more thought about what happened, and it's immediately back, and I've not really ignored it, because forgiveness really isn't like that, and God's forgiveness wasn't like that. The cross of Christ shows us that God was not interested in ignoring sin. That forgiveness came at a high cost and with much pain, typically to the forgiver. But it wasn't something God was just interested in sweeping under the rug. There was a process and a person involved with forgiveness. I want you to think about what this verse means when it says, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. Just as. So there might be a cross involved. There might be some sacrifice on my part involved. But what else is there about that teaching that helps us understand how to forgive people? I appreciated the things Nate said on the table today. I appreciated especially the verse that he read, or the verses he read in Romans 5. You know, Romans 5 is one of those texts it's like he said, they're so complex it's hard to wrap your brain around. But when did God die for us? When did God extend forgiveness to me? When did the cross happen? Well, it was even before me, but it was even before I ever came to Him asking for forgiveness. God moved first while I was an enemy. Can I tell you one of the most difficult things about me forgiving is that I typically sit back from a situation and say, well, if they'll come to me and they'll work really hard and make this right, then I'll forgive them. If they'll make it up to me, if they'll say enough nice words, if they say sorry enough, then I'll forgive them somehow. Typically, though, in that scenario, when they come to me and ask for forgiveness, whether it's with tears, whether it's not, I make them squirm a little. I'm going to punish them some. And I may tell them, well, you may get my forgiveness at some point, but not yet. God didn't do that. God died for us while we were His enemies. And 1 John chapter 2, verse 2 says that He died for the sins of the whole world. Everybody. Do you ever struggle with the concept that God's actually forgiven you? I don't know if you're like that. I am. There are things that I've done in my life. Some of them just seem so destructive to the people that I did them to that I can't really believe that God forgives me. That's part of it. There's been sins that I've repetitively done that I begin to doubt God can forgive me because, after all, I've asked for forgiveness like 10,000 times. If God was going to make an argument to you or me about how willing He was to forgive us or how interested He was in forgiving us, can you think of a better argument than Jesus Christ dying on a cross before we ever asked for forgiveness? Do you think God didn't know that I was going to do such destructive things? Did God not know that I was going to do things so repetitively? Yet, here's the point of forgiveness. Forgiveness cancels the debt in order to provide opportunity for full forgiveness. Here's sort of the idea. Has God forgiven the whole world's sins? Has God forgiven the whole world's sins? The answer is yes and no. The yes answer is God's canceled the debt, hasn't He? He paid the money for the debt to be canceled. But there's an expectation. And the expectation simply is penitence, people that come to Him asking for the debt money. But do you ever see God in those scenarios waiting to cancel the debt till after somebody comes? Or is it the other way around, that God moves first, cancels the debt, deals with it in his own mind or in his own world, extends the offer, and then waits patiently for reconciliation? If there's one failure, I think, in my forgiveness and our forgiveness as a whole as Christians, it's this failure. We've not gotten the order right about it. That somehow we've got to learn how to cancel the debt at cost to ourselves, us on the cross, extending the idea of forgiveness with a loving heart and waiting patiently for true penitence, for reconciliation. Now, by the way, let me point out a subtle difference. Forgiveness is a real thing, even if reconciliation doesn't happen. Like, I've sort of gone through this in my head. Do I have to forgive somebody if they don't repent? Like, do I have to really, you know, let go of the grudge? Do I have to really let go of the hurt if they don't repent? And I sort of hold on to it all my life and say as my excuse, well, they've never said sorry and they've never made it right, and therefore I've not forgiven them. And what I'd say about that is, be very careful. Because that doesn't seem to be what it means when it says forgive as Christ forgave. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. That I actually have, and this is the reality hopefully for us, we actually have dealt with the hurt. We've actually forgiven in our mind the person that's wronged us. We may not understand it. We may not appreciate it. We may not be willing to give them more money to hurt us with. But we've canceled the debt. And the reconciliation is a different thing than the forgiveness itself. Let's talk a little bit more about that. Now that we've sort of identified what forgiveness is and why it's so difficult, let me just say that there's a difference between understanding that and then finding the strength to do it. What does the Bible have to say about finding the strength to do it? Let's go to Luke chapter 17. Luke 17. Perhaps you're one of those people that I was talking about at the beginning, where you feel like you've been hurt so badly that the person that hurt you does not deserve forgiveness. And this gets back to the definition of the word forgiveness. Where's the grace in that attitude? Or let me say it a different way. Do you really think that you deserve your forgiveness? I believe that the motivation that gets us to the place where we become forgiving people is this one thing: the realization and the appreciation for the forgiveness that God's given us. And there's not really any other motivation or any other strength given except that. I think this text hints at that. Let's go ahead and look at some things together, starting in verse 1. For a long time, I've separated some of the thoughts in Luke 17, especially in these first 10 verses, and I thought they were talking about different things. I want to read verses 1 through 10 and then show you why I think they all fit together. Starting in verse 1. He said to his disciples, "It is inevitable that stumbling blocks come, but woe to him through whom they come. It would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the sea than that he would cause one of these little ones to stumble. Be on your guard. If your brother sins, rebuke him, and if he repents, forgive him. And if he sins against you seven times a day and returns to you seven times saying, 'I repent,' forgive him." The apostle said to the Lord, "Increase our faith." And the Lord said, "If you had faith like a mustard seed, you would say to this mulberry tree, 'Be uprooted and be planted in the sea,' and it would obey you. Which of you, having a slave plowing or tending sheep, will say to him who has come in from the field, 'Come immediately and sit down to eat'? But will he not say to him, 'Prepare something for me to eat and properly clothe yourself and serve me while I eat and drink, and afterward you may eat and drink'? He does not think, or he does not thank the slave because he did the things which were commanded, does he? So you too, when you do all the things which are commanded you, say, we are unworthy slaves. We have done only that which we ought to have done. All right, there's some things that we need to talk about in these few verses. Let's just look at the facts of this discussion. First of all, what's the point in the first couple verses? Number one, stumbling blocks will come, right? But woe to the man through whom they come. I just asked a question earlier. Do you ever struggle with the idea that God could ever forgive you? When I read verses 1 and 2 of Luke 17, this is the reason that I struggle with the idea that God could forgive me. Is because I know I'm that guy. I know that I am. Are you? Have you ever caused somebody to stumble? Have you? An ex-girlfriend, an ex-boyfriend, a friend that you didn't show the love of Christ to, you didn't show the right example to. You think back and you realize the wasted opportunity or the thing that you taught them that was not true about life or about the Lord, and you don't get it back. The stumbling over your hypocrisy was why they stumbled. And then you read a verse like this that says, it'd be better if a millstone were hung around my neck and I was thrown into the sea than for me to be the guy that caused somebody to stumble. Here's the problem. I am that guy. So what do we do then? You know, for a long time, I thought maybe what Jesus was saying here was, don't ever cause somebody to stumble. And if you ever cause somebody to stumble, then give up hope because you're done. God's not going to show you any mercy. God's going to throw you to the bottom of the sea. You know, I think there's something to that. That we're supposed to watch what we do so that we don't cause somebody else to stumble. But you know what? After I look at the whole context of this, do you know what I think might actually be going on here? What's the way that I might actually cause somebody to stumble so as to fall away from God? Look at the next verse, verse 3. Be on your guard. If your brother sins, rebuke him, and if he repents, forgive him. And if he sins against you 7 times a day and returns to you 7 times saying, I repent, forgive him. Let me point something out about this stumbling thing. I'm going to just ask for a show of hands because I want to illustrate this. How many of you connect with what I just said about you feel like you've probably caused somebody to stumble in your life or in their life? How many of you have done that? Now, how many of you intellectually can understand what I'm about to say? I know that I gave them a bad example. I know that I did something wrong, and I know that I hurt them and wronged them. But I didn't make them do wrong. It was their decision. They're the ones that decided. And I think I intellectually understand this, that someday they're going to stand in front of God, and God's going to say, why did you do what you did? And they may say, I met this hypocrite named Andy who did this thing. Do you think God's going to say, oh, well, you know what? Then it's not your fault. That's not what God's going to say, is he? It's their decision. But here's the difference. And I'm not saying that that doesn't mean I caused somebody to stumble. It just simply means I'm not sure that that's all this text is talking about. What about this, though? Somebody wrongs you, and they come to you so broken and heartbroken about their wrong that they say, would you please forgive me? I've done wrong. And you say to them, no. No. You live in that guilt, and you live in that despair, and you live with what you've done. No, I will not forgive you. Now, quick question. Out of the two scenarios I just gave, which one's going to cause more people to stumble? which one's going to cause more people to give up on the idea of grace and a God who forgives and the idea of reconciliation and the idea that God might somehow one day forgive me, when we stand between them and God and say, we'll never do what God would do. Can I tell you that I think in the context of this, that's the thing that makes people stumble more than anything else, is my unwillingness to show mercy. And if you understand what I'm saying, because you've had that happen to you, part of the reason that I struggle with the idea that God could ever forgive me is because there's been so many people in my life that wouldn't forgive me. Are we doing this to somebody? Why else does he say right after he says, make sure you don't cause anybody to stumble, but if they ask for forgiveness, you forgive them? How many times, God? Seven times? On another occasion, Jesus said more than that. 70 times 7. Well, why? And how? And that's their question in verse 5. Lord, increase our faith, because that seems unrealistic. That seems unbelievable that I could ever get to the place where I could forgive somebody for such things so many times. So Jesus tells a parable, starting in verse 6. Actually, kind of like two parables, the parable of the mustard seed, also the parable of the slave. What's the point of that parable of the slave? What's the point? Verse 10, so you too, when you do all the things which you are commanded, say, we are unworthy slaves, we have done only that which we ought to have done. Until I come to the place where I understand my unworthiness, until I come to the place where I understand my forgiveness, that God doesn't owe me anything, that I owe Him everything, and that even if I've tried to be as good as I can be, I'm still unprofitable, unless I have that attitude, then I'm never going to understand verse 4. Jesus telling this parable was meant to strengthen the faith of the apostles or disciples to become forgiving. And what he basically tells them is, don't ever think that you're so good as to not forgive. And you make sure that you don't cause somebody to stumble, perhaps by giving them some reason that they have to forgive you, but I think far more important than that, that you wouldn't forgive somebody. And by the way, wasn't that the problem with the Pharisees? Wasn't that how they shut the kingdom of God out for everybody else? Is that they walked around as if somebody, everybody else was so bad and so wrong that they couldn't possibly ever find mercy through me. And Jesus comes down quite hard on people like that, because there's no greater way to cause somebody to stumble than that. The point of forgiveness is about reconciliation. Let's go to Matthew 18 just for a moment. Matthew chapter 18, we're not going to read this parable, but starting in verse 21, this is another time that Peter asked, how many times should I forgive somebody? Seven times. And Jesus said, no, I tell you 70 times seven. But then he tells another parable about a guy who was forgiven a great debt that turns around and won't forgive his brother who owes him less. I want you to notice that this is in a context of something. Go back a few verses. I think most of us know this parable, so we're not going to spend any time on it. But go back a few verses to verse 7. Woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks, for it is inevitable that stumbling blocks come, but woe to the man through whom the stumbling block comes. It's in the same context, isn't it, as the last thing we read there in Luke 17. Stumbling blocks happen, and oftentimes happen because we won't be forgiving and we're unmerciful. Now skip down to verse 15. Look at 18:15. If your brother sins, go and show him his fault in private. If he listens to you, you have won your brother. But if he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you, so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every fact may be confirmed. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. What's the point of this text? The point of this text is reconciliation. To win the brother back. To not only forgive the debt and cleanse their conscience, but also, hopefully, in that mercy, that they move to a place where that evil behavior stops. When God said through Jesus, "Blessed are the peacemakers," in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 5, I think there's a lot of things to say about that characteristic, a peacemaker, but I'll say this about it. Peacemakers are different than peacekeepers and peace lovers. You may be a peace lover and say things like, you know, I love peace, but when people mess things up, what have I done? I still love peace. They've just sort of messed it up. You may be a peacekeeper and feel like you've never really done anything that wrong to cause trouble, and you just keep the peace in your life. Those two things are very different than being called a peacemaker, the heart of somebody who, when there's a problem that exists, they want to, in love, go address it. They don't like being at odds with people. They can almost barely stand to go to sleep at night with anger in their heart. They don't want the sun to go down because it hurts them so bad that there's a breach. I don't know how to make all of this real by just saying a bunch of words. Like, I don't know how to take all these, as Nate put it today, complex ideas and motivate me to do it without seeing it happen. So I want to tell you a story. I want you to look at this picture. You probably have seen this picture. I'll only leave it up for a minute because I think it's a disturbing picture. It won a Pulitzer Prize. It was taken, I think, June 8, 1972. You ever seen that picture? The little girl running down the middle of the street is named Kim Fu. She was 9 years old. That picture won a Pulitzer Prize because during the Vietnam War, some pilots dropped bombs on a town, and the napalm incinerated the town and burned a bunch of people. I read a story one time in the back of a newspaper in Arkansas, and I saved it. I'd seen that picture before. I never really thought about it. Can you imagine what that girl or what that young boy in front of the girl that was screaming in terror thought and has thought all of their life since that day? Can you imagine that? I mean, her clothes were burned off her from the napalm. She's got scars everywhere. She's had, I found out, more than 17 surgeries as of 1997 and lived with constant pain. Can you imagine that? I want you to imagine another side to that story. Imagine you were a guy named John Plummer, 24 years old, in the military, and you were a pilot who was told to go drop bombs on a town. And you ask the question, and this is a true story, well, what's there? It's only military, there's no civilians. You asked it twice. And twice you were told there's no civilians there. So you drop the bombs, you go to bed that night feeling like you've done your job. You wake up in the morning and that's the picture. And that was the picture John Plummer saw. And John Plummer said it ended his life. He couldn't tell himself, I just was doing my job. He couldn't be consoled by soldiers that said, hey, that just happens, man, it's war. He went home to a marriage that should have been fine. And in his guilt and in his pain from that, it wrecked his first marriage, it wrecked his second marriage, it wrecked his third marriage. He turned to alcohol. He turned to drugs. He completely lost it because he could see that picture in his head every time he closed his eyes. For 20-something years. Then one day, he was watching TV. And they showed that picture on the screen. And he'd seen it, it felt like 10 million times because it's everywhere. And it's his picture. He saw it on the screen and the newscaster said, "Stay tuned, we have a story about this girl coming up." And he thought, "I didn't even know if she was alive." He found out that this lady had become a Christian. She lived in Canada and she toured going around giving speeches about her life. And he thought to himself, "I got to go see her." So he went to see her. He heard her speak at a memorial in Washington, D.C. And in that speech, she said this. He listened to this. "If I could talk face to face with the pilot who dropped the bombs, I would tell him we cannot change history, but we should try to do good for the present and for the future to promote peace." Plummer heard her say that, and he wrote a note that said, "I'm that guy." And he had a policeman take it up to her. Well, some friends of his that had accompanied him said, "You need to see her." And so they pushed their way to the front. And as she was making her way off with newscasters around and everything else, somebody gave her the note and somebody told her, "He's right behind you." I want you to hear how she put it. It says, "Apprehensive about the media and the crowds, Kim was eager to get back to her hotel. But when an escort from the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund saw Plummer's note, he whispered to Kim that Plummer was right behind her. She took a few more steps and then she stopped. I couldn't move anymore. I stopped and I turned. And he looked at me," she said. "No news photographer took this picture, but in the lee of the Vietnam War Memorial, the soldier, now 49, and the child, now 33, embraced. She just opened her arms to me. I fell into her arms sobbing. All I could say is, 'I'm so sorry. I'm just so sorry.'" What would you do? I'd show them the scars. I'd say, "You look at me. Do you know how much money I've spent? You know how many days I've laid awake at night? You know how much pain I've been in? Look at me." Would you have slapped them? She hugged him and she said this, "It's all right. I forgive you. I forgive you." I read some more about that on the internet recently. And guess what I found out? They're really good friends now. They talk all the time. He calls her, she calls him. In fact, that's them, right there. You know what the power of forgiveness is? It's the power of a young girl to understand that no matter what pain was caused her in her life, she could let that go. And she says, because of what she learned about Jesus Christ. I think she had something to do with this, but this guy who'd wrecked all his marriages and became an alcoholic, do you know what he does now? He's a preacher. I don't know much about his theology. But I know he gets up week after week in some pulpit somewhere in this country and he tells people stories. He never would tell this story until this day. But now he tells people about it. And he preaches to people about forgiveness. Maybe that story is not good. Maybe that doesn't touch you. Maybe you think your story is better than that story and your reason for not forgiving is better than that. But I don't think so. Forgiveness is all we have. If you intend to wait out the rest of your life and not find forgiveness, you are going to be saddened. If you don't learn to forgive, Jesus made this very clear. If you do not forgive men their trespasses, neither will I forgive you yours. We have got to figure this out. We've got to. And it begins somewhere with understanding who Jesus is and what he's done for us and how he can heal us. If you know who he is and you want to give him your life, if you need our prayers, if you need to find some sort of strength to do what's right, or if you need to forgive somebody, or if you need to seek forgiveness from somebody, I want this song that we're about to sing to be the time where you figure all of that out. If you need our help, you can come and tell us. If you don't need our help, pray to God and make it right. I appreciate your attention. Let's go ahead and stand up and sing this song together.